Chapter 19. On the Road to Nowhen. Sean was woken by the camp fussing of a group of four men wearing aprons. "What's for breakfast?" he asked, struggling to sit up on the uncomfortably luxurious sofa he was laid out on.
"Very funny," said one, whose apron had stains and some flour on it.
"Just because I had to borrow this from the cook in a hurry."
"Well, serves you right, Mr. D."
"Forgetting the official apron at home," said another,
whose owner apron, like the others, had a pale blue trim and a red rose in the place where a sporran would otherwise feel quite at home.
"So, no breakfast," sighed Sean.
"You won't be interested in food when you find out what part of the ceremony you play. Ain't that right, Mr. B? Right you are, Mr. C?"
Sean sat up with a start, remembering an awakening with vaguely similar dialogue some millennia ago.
"Are you going to flay me alive?" he asked.
"No. We have a better way of stripping out your soul.
Won't hurt a bit."
"Not us anyway, eh, Mr. A?"
rejoined another, and the four laughed at their own in-joke.
"Who are you?" Sean asked.
"Shh! Secret. Let's just say we are men of letters.
This is a message brought to you by the letter A." They assisted the little drummer boy to stand dizzily up and led him out of the parlour room into the main entrance of the Serlepierre home.
"I'm home," cried Sean happily.
"I wouldn't count on it."
Sean's face took a fall when he recognized the voice as that of the First Consul, who had come to lead the procession, followed by Laplace. They were both also wearing the same sickly coloured aprons as the Messieurs Alphabet.
"Ah, Sean," said Napoleon, as upbeat as ever. "So you have been in the bowels of the time, cousin? You have had a glimpse of all time, n'est-ce pas? Tell me ma future, Sean. Tell me ma destiny."
"I can't do that." Sean shook his head.
"I also have had visions of the future in store for me. What does Elba mean? And who is this Helena woman, or perhaps Saint Helena? I get so attached to. And why is there a water closet in between?"
"Oh, that would be Waterloo."
"But I don't just want to see the future. I want to control it, own it."
A thought struck Sean.
"That could be what is causing the time collapse."
"It is a risk I am prepared to take."
"And everybody else has no say in it?"
"That's why I am emperor and you lot are cannon fodder. Ready, gentlemen?"
Napoleon presumed more expansively.
"Let us go."
The procession made its way into the kitchen, then down the stairs to the cellar, where Pappy would have his secret office and blogging centre in 210 years' time. And there, just where Sean had seen it in 2010, was the same open bookshelf door to the tunnel he had yet to pass through all that time in the future. On the lintel were chiselled the words, "Mind the gap." "I thought it only fair to leave a warning," explained Laplace. The route was lined by the invertebrates, still in full cuirassier armour and helmets, clanking swords in their elaborate leather harnesses, beady little red eyes watching Sean in unwavering conditional claws. And they all also wore the same pale blue-trimmed aprons as the others. To be fair, Sean did try hard not to laugh.
"This way," ordered Napoleon.
"No," cried Sean. "We can't go into the haunted house. It's dangerous."
"And that is why you are going first," agreed Napoleon.
The tunnel was lit by the same torches and wall brackets he had seen last time he had been there. Only this time there were flaming torches both ways he looked. The brick, though, was brand new. Napoleon explained.
"Laplace calculated that the only way to enter the house would be through le point mort, the dead point. And I am not referring to the cat."
Sean followed Napoleon's gaze and saw that there in front of them was the outstretched body of Shrody, the half-dead cat. Laplace took over the explanation.
"The point mort is located at the suspex, a precise location beneath the house, where there is equilibrium between the Vitruvian crystal and the chronoclysm, the time magma, developing beneath the crust."
"Then you built the tunnel," cried Sean to Napoleon, "so you could access the house safely from below."
"May we? You saw the results of any other approach?"
said Napoleon, referring to the pile of skeletons they had seen tricolouring the courtyard.
"And the crystal, is it finished?"
asked Sean, happy that it was Laplace he was speaking to, not Powell.
"Almost. Thanks to your help in leading us to the source of the time eggs, We now have enough eggs. Does one more needs to be put in place at the suspects, and the Vitruvian crystal will be ready.
Ready for what? Asked Sean, in a tone spatter-patterned with best-grade suspicion.
You will see, replied the ex-marquis. In fact, we will all have plenty of time to contemplate it.
They had reached the stairs and begun to ascend.
Careful, said Sean. There is a trapdoor up here.
Not yet, said Napoleon. That trick can only be used at one time, n'est-ce pas? We have no need of such artifice, you and I, Jean Salpierre.
As they passed between the two doors at the top of the stairs, Sean could see that in place of the rug and trapdoor in the floor, there was a wooden grate. As they crossed the grate, Sean was hit by a musty, freshly dug earth smell and a hollow space sound beneath their feet. On a rig over their heads was suspended a stone egg, directly above a hole in the grate, large enough to let it pass should it fall.
When this egg is let to fall, explained the First Consul, indicating a custom-made release mechanism and string leading off into a hole in the ceiling, it will fall into the exact place that will complete the Vitruvian crystal. And everything within La Malmaison, the haunted house, will be aligned with the cosmic background. We will enter the fifth realm of the ordinaire. Time will cease, and my destiny will be fulfilled.
What destiny? Asked Sean.
Can you not guess?
Yes, admitted Sean. I cannot guess.
With a reincarnated Shrody purring in long-awaited welcome around his legs, Sean led the procession of Napoleon, Laplace, the four men of letters, and a stream of clanking invertebrates up the staircase and into the enormous ballroom. It looked the same as the last time Sean had been there, except the pedestal in the dead centre, which had held the watch in 1500, had been replaced by the same pink stone slab Sean had seen there in 2010, the altar which had mailed Nonno as an attachment to another world. Now Sean knew the hieroglyphs on it meant it was the true Rosetta Stone, carved by the hand of John the Measurer himself as a copy of the palimpsest of Archimedes, effectively an instruction manual for his digital watch. And in front of the altar was the same short flight of stairs, rostrum and throne, on which Sean had last seen Nonno. And above it all hung the same enormous crystal chandelier on its heavy chain, adding to the whole scene some superfluous, ponderous authenticity. Napoleon took the natural centre of attention position directly at the base of the steps leading up to the rostrum, where Nonno had been tied to the sacrificial throne. This piece of furniture now stood empty, and beckoning Sean didn't hesitate to imagine who.
"Can the star of the show please take up his position?" asked Napoleon.
By a process of guess elimination, Sean figured he meant him.
"What is going to happen?" he asked inanely enough, while an invertebrate tied him by the ankles and wrists to the throne, as Nonno had been secured.
"Oh, come now, Sean, you have more experience of this than any of us, except the one, of course."
And Sean noticed that Napoleon unconsciously touched his temple when he said this.
"Bring out the crown," ordered Napoleon.
One of the invertebrates, who Sean recognized as the centurion he had seen take charge in Syracuse and play a chief beef-eater in London, opened the casket. He reached in to take out the iron crown of Lombardy, which Sean had first seen on the head of Cesare Borgia just outside in the courtyard of the haunted house, and had not seen since the centurion had shown it to him in 1699 on London Bridge, shortly before they had taken Jenny into it.
"Time to join your friends, pow," said Napoleon with a dramatic turn to Laplace.
At this, the Paul Laplace composite cried out in fear, recoiled, and tried to make a run for the stairs. He was seized almost immediately by the invertebrate guards.
"No,"
cried Pau unoriginally.
"Sean, help!"
Sean made a token struggle against the bonds on his wrists and ankles on the chair, then gave up, it could be said, slightly too quickly for form's sake. While two invertebrates held Pau down, the centurion played quoits with the crown on his dodging head. Once on, the same mystic, adult-audience-only greeny glow Sean had seen take Stinto in Syracuse and Elf in Pisa did its special effects trick in and around Powell's face. When it was over, Laplace rose in his place.
"Thank you, Your Excellency," he said,
I'm so glad to be rid of that blob of information dark in my head.
Good to have you back, ex-Marquis, said Napoleon. He lifted his arms and announced to the room of the faithful, Let the sacre de mimbly-jimbly commence.
You have forgotten something, said Sean.
Napoleon turned slowly to him. And just what is that?
You intend to complete the Vitruvian crystal now, 210 years ahead of schedule, correct? But how do you think you can break the TPF, the time paradox failsafe? Anything that is out of its proper time proves that you cannot complete the VC now. I'm here because of what happens in the future. You cannot change that.
Ah, but I can. By sending all the elements that are out of the rightful place in time into the cosmic background, what you call the spendermat, the timeline and the world that is created by it will be reset. Reset to the terms I determine.
But you do not have all the elements. Where is the watch? If that continues to exist out of time in the world, you cannot reset anything.
You think I don't know that?
Napoleon bunched up the green felt plush sleeve of his dress uniform, and there, on his wrist, was the digital watch. He took it off.
I shall miss you, Tiki-Toki. You have been most inspiring.
He suddenly turned to Laplace, holding the watch possessively.
Can't I keep just this, my little precious?
I am afraid not, Your Highness. It, along with the shrouds, and Sean, of course, must be returned to the Eternity Soup from whence they came. Napoleon placed the watch reverently on the centre of the altar.
Adieu, petite souris, mon ami.
It is ironic that the world's only remaining officially recognised time traveller should be in such a position, playing for time. But in the dying echo of his key stratagem blowing, that is what Sean did now. So you tricked me into revealing Leonardo's secrets. Napoleon looked up at Sean, now far above him on the rostrum.
It was really too easy. Your friend Pau thought he could control the great mind of ex-Marquis Pierre-Simon de Laplace. Not a chance. All along Laplace led him to believe so, and he and I had arranged to allow Pau to dupe you, Sean, into taking us to the egg source. Following the clues of Leonardo, only you could solve.
But why? What is it that you want?
To be the eternal emperor.
Sean went silent for a while at this.
But he is dead, he stammered.
Not so. Merely my prisoner. I will show you. Guards, hold me.
To Sean's great surprise, three invertebrates seized Napoleon, who began to struggle and cry out in anger and frustration. Laplace approached with the crown and placed it on Napoleon's squirming head. The same green special effects light that had danced around Laplace moments before now did its thing around Napoleon's face. Then he relaxed.
Bah, that's better. Out you come, Cespuglio.
The emperor in training squawked up at the guards.
You can release me now.
So, nodded Sean from his platform. Cespuglio lives. How is that possible? I saw him killed. Napoleon readjusted his dress and hair pedantically.
You saw his host get the chop, but Cespuglio lived on. Much weakened, that is how I found him in Monzer.
Monzer? Sean realized that a century is a long time to be absent from the timeline. All sorts of people can get up to all sorts of things.
I invaded Italy in 1796 to free her from the horrors of the Austrian foreign occupation.
To impose the glories of the French foreign occupation, I suppose, finished Sean.
Exactement. While I was there, I went to the Monzer Cathedral, where they keep the crown. I wanted to try it on, to check that it fits.
He moved over to the table, took the crown, and admired its jewels.
The legendary Corona Ferrea, the iron crown of Theolinda, Queen of Lombardy. 1,000 years ago, she had it made from a nail from the Holy Cross Emperor Constantine says he found on one of his pillage romps east. This crown is magic. Why? Because it contains the power of imagination. All the kings and queens of northern Italy, emperors of the unholy non-Roman quasi-empire, Cesare Borgia, cardinals burn and plunder, and even a little-known English criminal called William Chaloner, have worn this crown at one time, or more precisely, two times in their lives, exactement deux fois.
Sean had to acknowledge the ingenuity of it. And in so doing, every rampaging king and demagogue of history has downloaded Cespuglio and uploaded him back into the crown at their expiry date. But just a minute, the others I understand, but how did Chalonet, a mere king of thieves, get to wear the crown?
He made a stopover while on one of those faded glory package tours of northern Italy tyranny spots.
But Cespuglio was executed with Chalonet in 1699.
Ah, Sean, you cannot kill someone who is not alive, as you and I understand. Not living in any particular time, that person cannot be killed. The invertebrates took Chalonet's head from London Bridge and placed the crown on it, extracting what was left of Cespuglio's consciousness. And there he was kept, weak and ineffective, until I put the crown on that day in Monzer. And in so doing, I took him into my own mind. He thought to control me. Me. Napoleon, I kill you first, Bonaparte. He could not control me. No, I controlled him. I made him compliant to my will, forced him to reveal all his secrets, and to grant me the power to command the invertebrates, as you see.
He indicated the honor guard around them in the room. And he told you about me, the watch, the house, Leonardo, everything? Napoleon nodded. So that is why you went to Egypt. Cespuglio told you you needed to get the Rosetta Stone to make the altar for the Vitruvian crystal.
No, mon ami, that was you.
Me?
Mais oui. It was you, Jean Sulpierre, who told us everything. You have only yourself to blame. By helping him write the codex, you helped Leonardo list for us quite conveniently, thank you. All the elements that were out of their proper time.
There was a pause while Sean took this on board. And those other gentlemen? I gather they would be the Rosicrucians.
Secret alphabetic order of the Brothers of the Rosy Crucible, at your service, said Mr. D in the cook's apron, and he curtsied comically. We are fully licensed and registered with the Underground Chamber of Verity Traders, stated Mr. B, unrolling a blood-signed and spattered certificate. Who would give up an invitation to eternal life? Said Mr. C, and the four bowed to Napoleon in perfect sycophancy.
Our sacred texts, added Mr. A, recount that Egyptians had attempted to create Vitruvian crystals by arrangements of porphyry inside pyramids, orientating them on the North Star and using prismic geometry. It is said they had the power to transport to another world the souls of dead kings, queens, and...
He paused and looked at Trodi, who was happily giving herself a nether region bath on the steps of the rostrum.
Cats.
Reincarnation, laughed Sean. Mr. C admonished him.
Someone who jumps time with the ease of making an omelette should not be so sceptical.
The four Rosicrucians, Laplace and Napoleon, now each took an egg on a golden chain from the centurion. These they hung around their necks, then formed themselves into a circle around the altar, with Archimedes' inner circle now in place, the geometry of the Vitruvian three-dimensional projection, as Luca Pacioli had calculated, was now almost complete. Sean realized that the strange sensation of power that he had sensed on entering the haunted house had not been his imagination, but had now grown to something far more tangible, and was emanating, without a doubt, from the altar behind him. Positions now adopted, Napoleon signaled the centurion, who picked up the crown and took it to the altar, where he placed it in its exact centre, and over the Sangreal watch. Immediately all six of the red rubies around its rim began to shine, and shimmery images projected from it. The hexagogo has been re-established, explained announced Laplace from his place on the inner circle. The crystal is ready to receive the final egg, and then we will be able to connect across the gap.
Mind the gap, chanted the invertebrates.
Only now did Sean notice a standing lever, much like a railway point switch, in the place of honour in front of the rostrum. To this lever was attached a string, which passed down through a hole in the floor, presumably to the mechanism which would release the egg two floors below. In this way Napoleon, while remaining in his rightful position as one of the six figures of the hexagogo, would still be able to release the egg at the precise moment necessary and complete the Vitruvian crystal. Although it was behind and below him, Sean could just see that the crown was now a brilliant golden bubble of glow, several times its original size, as it lifted off to hover above the altar, in the dead center of the house and the VC it made, illuminating the watch below it. Six figures were forming in its projections, initially dark, hooded figures, the ones Sean had seen in 2010 when Nonno had disappeared. The figures grew larger and moved further from the altar until they occupied the exact same places as they had in 2010, forming a circle within the circle made by Napoleon and his five followers. Then, gradually, the dark cloaks dissolved to reveal the features of the shrouds. The first he recognized was a glorious sight to Sean, Jenny, even though every time he had seen her, she had been occupying a different person. Her trademark beauty clearly identified her. She gazed ahead, but not at him. She could not see him. The next was just as unmistakably Pao, looking as handsome and bewildered as usual, as he gazed into the middle distance. Others were Stinto, Amour, and Elf, and the sixth and final figure in front of Napoleon was that of Gespulio the Younger, looking resplendently ugly in his original Roman uniform and quite put out. The six new shroud contenders, Napoleon, Laplace, and the four Rosicrucians, stepped forward into the places where the images were hovering. To Sean's horror, the images of the shrouds began to flicker and dim. "Stop!" cried Sean. "What are you doing to them? You're causing them to disappear. Jenny, Pao!"
"You see, Sean, when I complete the crystal, their raison d'être literally disappears. How can they be present in the VC at the time of its completion in 2010 if it no longer completes then but now, eh? What will happen to them? They, like all the future from this moment on, will have to man the gap."
"Prisoners of another world, like my Nonno?"
"Yes, but it's not fair." "It is not unfair to someone who does not exist. As far as my new world is concerned, they never did, or should I say will, exist. They exist only in your memory."
"And me?" demanded Sean. "I have to pass across the gap now because the VC completes in 1800. 2010 will never happen."
"Exactement. Eternity, Sean. Just think. You will be surrounded by people."
He waved his hands to indicate the shrouds and the invertebrates.
"But only you will have a soul, because only you will have a memory."
"All of this, this suffering, just so you can play war games through history like Gespulio?"
"No, not like Gespulio. Better. Infinitely better. Whereas Gespulio brought war and havoc, commendable in his own quaint way, I instead will bring peace to all the world and its history forever."
"But don't you see," appealed Sean, "somehow the creation of the Vitruvian crystal causes the timeline to collapse. There is no future. There will be no time, just as my Nonno warned."
"But I don't need a future. I can play in the past. I have always wanted to be Julius Caesar, without the stabbing in the back part this time."
Napoleon indicated the Rosicrucians and Laplace in the Hexagogo.
"That is why I have invited these gentlemen to accompany me. And just think, Sean. A troop of five Tom Riders fanatically loyal to me and to me alone, occupying the minds of all the key scientific and political figures of every age of history. Then I will be the true Emperor Eternel."
While Napoleon was occupied with his task of absorbing the shroud energy, Sean appealed to the centurion who was still standing next to him on the rostrum in his clanky cuirassier uniform. "Sir, please. My grandfather was transported somewhere by the altar. Do you know where he is?"
"Yes."
"Where?"
"He is the extreme being,"
responded the creature in his metallic, synthesized voice. "The supreme being?"
"No, extreme. He is out on a limb."
"And what is this extreme being?"
"The soul of the invertebrates across the gap where we come from."
"Is that where you intend to send me now?" asked Sean.
"Yes."
"Centurion," demanded Sean, "can there be two of these extreme beings?"
"No."
"Then, if I'm sent across the gap, what will happen to my Nonno?" The centurion did not answer. "What will happen to Nonno?" shouted Sean. "What if he is lost by my taking his place? Don't do this, please." The centurion adopted the good soldier's selectively deaf posture.
"Please," stammered Sean, then rallied. "I command it. The extreme being does not wish it."
The centurion hesitated, obviously trying to determine the legitimacy of advance orders.
"Please," begged Sean, "I don't know what you are, what the invertebrates are, obviously not human."
"We are human,"
replied the centurion finally.
"What is left of humans in 2,222 years after the completion of the Vitruvian crystal?"
"After? So you are robots?"
"Cyborgs. We have lost all organic parts."
"How is that possible and yet still be human?"
"Our soul is run by the extreme being."
"The extreme being is all your souls?"
"One soul, happy army. It is more efficient."
"Efficient? For what? Survival?"
"For the war."
"What war?" Like you and me, this discussion had lost Sean entirely, but he knew he needed to learn what he could while he still had time.
"The eternal war,"
replied the centurion tonelessly.
"Is that why you need an eternal emperor?"
"Yes."
"But why is Cespuglio, the eternal emperor, here in my world?"
"He escaped when the Vitruvian crystal was completed."
"Escaped? He was a prisoner?"
"We are all prisoners across the gap."
"Then why are you here?" asked Sean.
"To break the inversion of time."
"Ah, that's how you get your name. And how do you propose to prevent this inversion of time?"
"By eliminating all rogue elements."
"But don't you see? It is Cespuglio. He is the rogue element. And Napoleon will be as well if he takes his place."
Sean looked at the figures projecting from the crown, still barely visible over the new usurpers.
"The shrouds, I think, belong to my world, not yours."
"I obey the Emperor,"
said the centurion as matter-of-obediently as a cyborg can aspire to.
"I see. So you're in a catch-22, aren't you? You will never solve the problem because while the rogue elements are still on the loose, you are programmed to obey the Eternal Emperor."
"We must obey the extreme being across the gap and the Eternal Emperor here in this world."
"But the Eternal Emperor has no intention of resolving anything, don't you see? That is why he always found a way to secretly let me escape. In Syracuse, from this house in 1500, from the Leaning Tower. That's why Cespuglio allowed Galileo to do one last experiment with the watch. Of course, with me and the watch still free, you were forced to continue to obey him."
Sean nodded at the savage face of Cespuglio, now almost entirely absorbed by that of the First Consul taking his place.
"He loves this situation, able to wage non-stop war through history like this. With your help, he is invincible. And even if he does lose, he can upload himself into the crown, knowing he will be downloaded by the next power-hungry megalomaniac that comes along. That's why, when he was finished playing Emperor Constantine, he arranged for his helmet to be made into a crown, to ensure he would always occupy a king."
The centurion's eyes flickered a little as he processed this data that had made his existence an eternal do-and-die loop.
"Listen to me, centurion," Sean went on. "Like this, you will never save your people, your world, from the destruction of the timeline. I don't know what this inversion is you wish to break, or what the solution is, but I think I know where to start. Tell me, is there any other way of getting across the gap without dislodging the extreme being?"
"Yes,"
answered the centurion at length.
"Enough," bellowed Napoleon.
All the projected shrouds had by now merged with the figures in the inner circle. Napoleon placed his hands on the lever.
"I think, Jean Salpierre, it is time to say our eternal goodbyes."
"Marquis," pleaded Sean.
"Goodbye, Jean Salpierre," replied Laplace. "In a way, I envy you this opportunity you have to vision the entirety of time, but I'm sorry it had to be like this. Try to remember me kindly."
"That I will," replied Sean, recalling similar farewells to other great scientists, his unlikely consultants through the ages.
On a signal from Napoleon, the centurion prepared to push the chair and Sean back onto the altar at the same moment in which Napoleon pulled the lever to release the egg 2 stories below. Then he did a kind of double take as he sensed something. He carried out a short search and found in Sean's pocket the stone egg he had kept from Leonardo's glider. The centurion held the egg up for Napoleon to see. Napoleon looked surprised and said,
"This is strange.
You had the means to escape all along, Sean, yet you chose to remain. Why?
I'm tired of running, said Sean sadly, his last hope crushed. I wanted to put an end to all of this, one way or another. I thought if there was a chance of seeing my Nonno again, helping Jenny and the others, I should take it. They are counting on me. I had to at least try.
Very noble, young Sean, nodded Napoleon. Worthy of respect.
Thank you.
I said worthy. I did not say you would get it. Throw him in.
The chair began to move backwards.
I thus pull the string on history.
And Napoleon pulled the lever. Sean closed his eyes. After a long while, he opened them. He was looking up at the chandelier above him. He was hovering, and everybody in the room was completely still. After quite a while, he realized that assessment was not correct, and in fact he was moving downwards, and the centurion above him was also moving, only very, very slowly, and ever more slowly. The golden light of the crown was now all around him, only it seemed to have taken a bluer tinge. This blue light deepened, and gradually darkened more and more, until everything went piecemeal black, and Sean found himself wondering about Laplace's blob of dark. Hello, reality, he thought.
Hello, victim, he fancied he heard it answer.